Ohio, Texas, West Virginia, you thought these were states, but at this time of year, my friend, their teams, the expert rates, according to the likelihood they'll finish at the top or make the boosters mopish when they all get hurt and flop. The expert in this case is Dan Wetzel, who writes about college football for Yahoo Sports and joins me now on the line. Dan, how have you spent the long, empty months since we last talked about the Bowl Championship Series?
Well, fortunately, in college football, we have recruiting for the buy your tailback season. Then you have spring football. Then you have all the guys taking summer work to make up for all the failed classes during the year.
Quotation marks around work.
Yes, so, you know, you have the 32-credit summers and things like that. So there's actually quite a lot of drama all year round in college football.
Former Texas quarterback Vince Young, last year's national championship game hero, has now gone on to the National Football League. Does this mean the Longhorns have no chance to repeat?
I think Bevo will still be in the action here.
Bevo the mascot. We must let people know what you're talking
about. Bevo the mascot. I think it's Bevo number 8 by now. It's a huge steer that they run out in the field. They will also run out a lot of other talent. Vince Young, I think, was the key to winning the national championship. I don't think Texas will win it, but they will not fall off the face of the earth. They have some good young quarterbacks, including the wonderfully named Colt McCoy.
Colt McCoy, no danger that this guy would major in nuclear physics.
No, he was not going to be a cellist. He was going to play college football at Texas or be a bull rider or maybe a country singer. Vince Young will go down as the greatest quarterback in Texas football history, but Colt McCoy is the best-named football player in the history of Texas.
The Longhorns have an early game against this year's preseason number one team, Ohio State. This is a rematch of the great game that Texas won last year. Will the Buckeyes get revenge, and will furniture once again burn in the streets of Columbus, Ohio? And if there ever was a rhetorical question, that's it.
It's the smell of victory.
Sofas
on college campuses around America. I think Ohio State can handle Texas. It'll be a highly anticipated game in early September. Ohio State has a great team, great offense. They did replace 9 starters on defense, so that's going to be the question. But there's always talent in Columbus, so there's high hopes for the Buckeyes this season.
It's not often that a school loses 2 Heisman Trophy winners in the same year, but that happened to USC. 2004 winner quarterback Matt Leinart and 2005 recipient running back Reggie Bush have both moved on to the pros. Still, most preseason polls have the Trojans in the top 5. Is this possible?
USC absolutely has the recruiting machine rolling right now, and for good reason. There's very few reasons why you wouldn't want to play football at USC. They have an exciting team. You have a great city in Los Angeles, all that local talent. So they had built up a tremendous amount of talent through the years, the guys that hadn't gotten their chance to start because there were so many great players on that last team. Now it is their turn. So they're still the best team in the West.
This year's early Heisman favorite, Notre Dame quarterback Brady Quinn, and that's not a bad name for a quarterback, is it? Anyway, his photo is on the cover of just about every football magazine on the newsstands. Does this year's most hyped player actually live up to the billing and lead the Fighting Irish to a national title?
Well, Brady Quinn really game took off when Notre Dame hired Charlie Weiss as their coach, and Charlie Weiss was the offensive coordinator for the New England Patriots for a number of years, and obviously they have great quarterback play there. And he runs a very sophisticated offense that Quinn has begun to grasp and probably will exceed. He has a terrific offensive group around him. The question on Notre Dame is defensive speed. Ohio State scored, really ran them up and down the field last year in a bowl game, so that's one of the questions. They also have a very difficult early schedule, so Notre Dame has to be at their best right off the bat, because in September, they could be a good team and still lose a couple games.
Dan, I'm told that knowledgeable college football fans, if that's not an oxymoron, have tabbed West Virginia as the so-called dark horse pick to win it all. What do you think?
West Virginia has a number of things going for them, including a lot of talent. They have a great sophomore quarterback and running back that led them to an 11-1 season last year. They also have the most favorable schedule. The Big East Conference is by far the weakest of the major conferences. They have virtually no tough non-conference games. Really, they only have one game against a ranked team all season, and that is at the University of Louisville. And in the quirky and bizarre way that college football determines its champion, sometimes it's better to be undefeated than necessarily the best team. And that's where West Virginia becomes everyone's dark horse, because they have the opportunity to be 12-0 at the end of the year.
So do you have a pick for national champion? You've said a lot of nice things about a lot of big schools, but do you have a national champion pick so we can ridicule you in December?
Well, the thing about this season is that, unlike the last few where you said, well, USC is going to be the overwhelming favorite, or Oklahoma was an overwhelming favorite, you don't have that this year. There's about six or seven teams garnering a lot of attention. The one that I like is Louisiana State. They have a difficult schedule, but I think they have the best defense in college football. And if they can get by Auburn early in September, I think they could roll to a national championship.
Dan Wetzel covers college football, among other things, for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks again.
Always a pleasure.
Instant Replay has been providing sports fans the opportunity to see disorienting hits, rim-rattling dunks, and great catches for years. More recently, it has been providing officials with the chance to take another look at close calls, or in the case of football, calls coaches have challenged whether or not they're close. The most recent sport to adopt Instant Replay as final arbiter will be on display at Flushing Meadows in New York. Beginning Monday, Robert Rand has our story.
Hi, I'm Serena Williams, and I play tennis.
Our story begins with tennis great Serena Williams, almost exactly 2 years ago, September 7th, 2004.
I hit a ball that was in, I mean, clearly in, wasn't even anywhere close to the line, and the umpire saw it out.
Williams was playing Jennifer Capriati at the U.S. Open at Flushing Meadows. It was the quarterfinals, third set, first game, when it happened.
What's going on? Excuse me? That ball was so in! No, it was not. What the heck is this? No, that ball, this is amazing.
I don't argue. I never argue, because I always try to, you know, be real professional, but the ball was clearly at least, you know, a foot in. It wasn't even close to being out, and so it was very bizarre.
The United States Tennis Association apologized to Serena and, in collaboration with the men and women's professional tennis tours, set its sights on adopting the instant replay for the game. The USTA conducted a full-fledged test run this summer, and beginning Monday, the instant replay will be unveiled at the Arthur Ashe and Louis Armstrong stadiums of the U.S. Open itself. Serena Williams is pleased.
I think the instant replay is probably one of the best upgrades that's happened to tennis, period.
But this is not your mother's instant replay. This is high-tech 21st century stuff.
We'll have 10 cameras positioned around each court here in Flushing Meadows, and each of those cameras is focused on a specific part of the court.
Paul Hawkins is the inventor of Hawkeye, a sports tracking device that accurately answers the only big question: was the ball in or out?
So if a player feels that he's had a bad call, he now has the ability to challenge that call to the umpire, who will then announce it to the crowd. And by the time the challenge has been announced to the crowd, we're able to have on cue ready a virtual recreation of the point.
That video is shown on stadium screens so everyone can see. And what they see is a computer-enhanced replay of the tennis ball's flight path and point of impact. It looks like a comet with a long tail, something right out of NASA. Players can make unlimited challenges, as long as they're right. But a player is allowed only two incorrect challenges per set, three if the set goes to a tiebreaker. After that, no more challenges are allowed.
Mr. Safin is challenging the call of faults on the left service line.
Murat Safin of Russia used the instant replay at a recent tournament in Washington, D.C.
He's right. I'll tell you, these guys are on it here. All the three challenges that they've all been correct from the players literally caught the back of the line.
Safin's challenge was successful, and the line judge's call was reversed. On the very next serve, Safin challenged again.
And he's right again.
Ladies and gentlemen, the call is overturned.
Wow.
Game 7.
This is too much here.
The instant replay system has been a very big hit with players and fans alike. Amelie Mauresmo is the number one ranked player on the women's professional tour.
It's good for us because sometimes it clears our mind just to make sure that if we have a doubt, we have the opportunity to make sure that this was the right decision or the wrong and then change it. So I think it's great.
One of the few skeptical voices has been that of Roger Federer, the best tennis player in the world. He was an early opponent of Hawkeye, arguing that the system's high cost meant that it couldn't be used on every tournament court, which Federer felt was unfair. As for the fans...
The American public understands instant replay. They get it. They like it.
David Brewer is the U.S. Open tournament manager. He says the instant replay involves the audience in the match.
I've watched personally through the course of the summer where players see a call, hear a call, look at the line as they normally would have in the past, and look. And suddenly the crowd's going, challenge, challenge. They literally sort of smack themselves on the head and go, I'd like to challenge that call.
Through 5 weeks of use this summer and a total of more than 700 challenges, the chair umpires prevailed 61% of the time, the players 39%. Paul Hawkins, the instant replay inventor, analyzed the data.
For the people that have not sat down and called lines, it is an incredibly tough job to do. And I think as much as anything, what has happened this summer is actually we've highlighted just what a good job the line judges do because in a vast majority of the cases, what we're doing is confirming that the call that they made was actually correct.
Hawkins says his objective for the U.S. Open the next 2 weeks is to keep Hawkeye working correctly. The last thing he wants is a match point challenge for his system software. For Only a Game, I'm Robert Rand in Flushing Meadows, New York.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. First, LeBron James buys Cleveland Cavaliers, trades self to Los Angeles Lakers. NFL collapses after nation suddenly gets its priorities straight. No, don't panic. There is no more danger of the NFL collapsing than there is of the nation getting its priorities straight. And LeBron James isn't a Laker. These reports and lots of other equally unlikely and utterly fictional developments are the work of the imagination of Dave Sereva, the creator of TheBrushback.com, and more recently a book titled The Brushback Report. Dave Sereva joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
One of my favorite entries in the Brushback Report is headed, Sports Writer Can't Stop Ranking Things. This is a guy with a serious job-related problem.
Right. Well, a lot of those guys, are a little obsessive-compulsive, everything has to be ranked, every statistic, every...
Top ten this.
I imagine in their personal lives, they probably carry some of that over.
Much to the dismay of their spouses.
Right.
For sure.
I'm sure they're ranking, their top 10 pairs of socks.
What inspired you to begin composing Brushback.com and then the Brushback Report?
I always wanted to be a sports writer, but I could never really cut the mustard at that.
God, what an ambition.
It seems like a cushy job, doesn't it? I started writing satirical articles just for my own amusement. I happened to have a friend who was a web designer, mm-hmm. and I said, let's put these on a website. Then eventually, word of mouth spread. I got a little bit of a following.
Word of mouth and word of web.
Word of web, message boards, chat rooms, things like that. You don't have to advertise.
And did a publisher call you, or did you shop this idea around making a book?
I just got an email from Random House. After I realized it was not a joke, I took their first offer and said, where do I sign?
And you realize, of course, that there are aspiring writers bursting into tears as you say this.
Yes, cry me a river, pal.
I guess no sport or sports executive escapes your satirical intent, but don't you think the story titled MLS Commissioner Invited to Steroid Hearings Out of Politeness was unnecessarily cruel?
Well, a lot of them are, but that's what's fun about them. But if you, I sat through those steroid hearings. I watched them, and it did seem like they were just kind of patronizing me a little bit because, you know, it's soccer. Who cares what he thinks?
Well, of course.
No offense, Don Garber.
In your story, Don Garber calls the investigators and says, what time should I be there?
And when he talks, they take that opportunity to go do errands and take a break and eat lunch, things like that. So I guess it was okay that he showed up.
Have soccer fans complained? I mean, has anybody been unhappy enough with the satire here that they've said, hey, wait a minute, you've gone too far?
Oh, well, I get emails from people all the time. I actually get emails from a lot of people who think the stories are real and accuse me of being a liar or being grossly inaccurate.
And you say, well, yes.
That's the idea. I am lying and being grossly inaccurate. But you would be surprised. Is the most off-the-wall stories you could find, people think they're true.
Well, give me some examples. What stories have people mistakenly taken seriously?
The one about the Make-A-Wish Foundation, kid asking the Make-A-Wish Foundation to punch Barry Bonds in the crotch.
Mm-hmm.
I had several people say, that kid is unbelievable. How could he say that? What a brat. You know, I don't care that he's sick. You can't say that. I'm going to stop supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. How could they? These are otherwise intelligent people who just, for some reason, got the wrong idea.
To take up a local issue, one of your entries has the Boston Red Sox telling their fans to get a life.
Right.
What do you suppose would happen if some member or some members of the Boston Red Sox actually did that, you know, went on TV after the game and said, come on,
I would applaud.
A baseball game. Get a life.
I would applaud, personally, if they did that.
And you got a Red Sox
hat. And I have a Red Sox hat. I need to get a life myself. It's taken entirely too seriously, and you know, to me, it's all about marketing and branding, and that's how they want us to be, I don't know, enamored with it. I mean, when I was growing up, everybody loved the Red Sox, but it wasn't quite like it is today. People probably could stand to get a life.
That's not a phenomenon limited to Boston.
No, absolutely not. It's sports in general.
You know, speaking of branding and labeling, I'm looking now at the cover of the Brushback Report, and there's an absolute lack of corporate logos. I don't quite understand.
No, we don't have any endorsements. No endorsements yet. I would love to have it be like a NASCAR thing where we have endorsements all over it, but we haven't gotten there yet.
But that is your aim.
Oh, absolutely. I'm for sale. You know, if anybody out there is listening, you want to advertise on the site.
Any corporate head honchos?
I am for sale. I do have my price. I don't have any integrity, so.
Dave Sereva is the creator of thebrushback.com and the author of The Brushback Report, published by Ballantine Books. Dave, thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Success in a sailing regatta usually requires months of preparation, computer-designed sails made of space-aged material, and a seaworthy and speedy boat. But not always. Only a Games Karen Given recently attended a regatta that required none of the above.
The town beach in Jamestown, Rhode Island, is the perfect place for an early morning stroll, unless it happens to be the August morning when Chris Powell walks up and down that same beach with a megaphone.
Hey ladies, be careful now, no testing.
Chris Powell is the chief fool for the 29th annual Fool's Rules Regatta.
The chief fool is the guy who's in charge of this whole craziness. He's the guy who makes the rules, he's the guy who can change the rules, he's the guy who tries to make fools out of everybody here.
Actually, participants don't need much help making fools of themselves, and the rules simply state that teams have 2 hours to build a sailboat out of non-marine materials. That means no boat sails, no boat rudders, no boat oars. So what can they use?
Anything that floats. I mean, I've had ice blocks, I've had hay bales, I've had dog houses, Volkswagens, picnic tables. You name it, it's probably been tried.
The regatta is sponsored by the Jamestown Yacht Club, and many of the participants, both young and old, boast impressive sailing resumes. But knowing how to sail doesn't necessarily improve the chances of keeping a handmade vessel afloat for the regatta's 500-yard downwind course.
All right, get ready. 29th Annual Fool's Rules Regatta. Ready, set, begin construction.
At precisely 9 a.m., 62 teams of all ages spring into action. Spectators meander down the beach watching boats being built from ice chests, oil barrels, yoga balls. And is that an inflatable mattress?
Sure, of course. Just got to keep the floor side up, you know, and that's the most comfortable. Yeah, that's what we found.
boat is called Bin There because they're made out of bins. It's made out of bins.
How many people does this boat hold?
Three.
Three?
Normal people.
Normal.
We haven't found them yet. If you find them, just send them over.
I've made boats out of wood planks with sails of like plastic and stuff. And then when I was really younger, I had this little turtle sandbox, and I used that, and it got all the way there, though.
No, is that the point, just getting all the way there?
Yeah,
it's fun. You don't care if you get there first.
No, it's fun to try and make it, too.
Yeah.
It's going to be a good breeze. It's going to be a lot of catastrophes, a lot of shipwrecks.
Most of today's entries are trying to avoid catastrophe, but not an unusual boat called Bridge Go Boom, a long, skinny, canoe-like hull topped by a plywood model of the Jamestown Bridge. It will hold 8 girls aged 9, 10, and 11, captained by a blonde named Amina. At the end of the race, the team will reenact the demolition of the Jamestown Bridge, setting off noisemakers for effect. But will Amina finish the job and dump her crew into the water?
I don't think so, because last year I did, and the mast broke. I was proud of myself, but I don't want to break another mast. Probably we're going to get wet at the end, because if we don't tip over, then we're probably going to go swimming afterwards because we didn't tip over.
Class 1 and Class 2 boats. Class 1s can go in the water, move towards the starting line, down near the boat ramp.
Spectators and sailors crowd the far end of the beach as race time approaches for Class 1, boats with a single crew member. This is Cindy's first Fool's Rules regatta, not surprising since she lives in Ohio. Her boat, made of an ice chest and catering trays, doesn't look much like a boat, but she's proud of it nonetheless.
This is the boat. What do you think?
What is it?
It's a boat.
Okay,
it's got outriggers and floaters. And this is the baler and the anchor. It's a quality boat.
The baler,
there's nothing to bail.
Cindy's sail is a brightly colored umbrella, which she'll open when the cannon goes off. But can a single umbrella really pull her 500 yards down the beach?
I'll be optimistic if I go about 5 feet. But I'm, you know, there's only 4 people in the race, so I figure I'm at least going to be in the top 4.
Cindy and her competitors wade out into the water, where they perch precariously on top of their wobbly vessels. Before the starting cannon even goes off, they've all fallen off their boats at least once.
You guys ready? On your mark? Get set? Go!
Balancing on top of an ice chest isn't as easy as it looks. By the time Cindy finally opens her umbrella, minutes have gone by, and she's barely moved.
Yeah, I don't think she's going anywhere.
But she's holding on.
Cindy, lift your sail.
Go, Cindy, go!
The races continue, with Class 2 for 2 crew members, 3 for 3, 4 for 4, until it's finally time for the unlimited class, where crews can be as large as the boat can carry. The Boy Scouts quickly take the lead with their Caddyshack-themed boat, made of styrofoam and shipping pallets and covered in shiny plastic grass. Not nearly as successful is Seafare. 7 members of a cooking light club dressed in chef's hats and sitting on plastic dining chairs.
You guys are a failure. You guys are not doing very well.
Seafare's troubles begin almost immediately when those plastic chairs start tipping over and dumping the crew in the drink. The sail refuses to unfurl, leaving Seafare's secret weapon, a large bunch of brightly colored balloons, as its only propulsion device. It's not nearly enough to get the boat over the starting line, let alone to the finish.
No paddling! You're sculling your paddle there. You're sculling.
Disqualified!
As the soggy chefs return to shore, the crew gathers to try to explain what happened.
I was the first one in! But it was fun. Water's great. Good friends. What's not to like?
It's got to be hard when the race organizer keeps yelling at you that you're a failure.
He did?
He did tell us we were a failure?
We've got to go have an award with him.
You ready for the awards?
Yeah!
Everybody have a good time?
Yeah!
We're going to see you next year?
Yeah!
Yes, that's it. Okay.
Chief Fool Chris Powell hands out ribbons to the top three finishers in each class, as well as special awards for most ingenious design, the judges award for best theme, and the honor that everyone wants, even if they're afraid to admit it, worst example of naval architecture.
Called Seafair. Could not stay on it. They could not keep it together. It rolled over and split in half. They didn't even get past the starting line.
The captain abandoned ship.
Are there people in that crew that are afraid to come forward?
Eventually, all seven members of Seafair are coaxed out of the crowd to receive their award. Minutes later, it's time to break apart the boats for firewood, salvage what can be used again next year, and clean up the beach. As Powell continues to revel in the fantastic failure of Seafair's design, he smiles broadly and declares the day another success.
Very successful. It's always successful. You can't be a failure when you're having fun.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Jamestown, Rhode Island.
Please clean up the beach. Leave everything as you found it. Clean it up. Take all your debris. Clean up. No t-shirts left if you didn't get them.
I won't leave you drifting down, but whoa, it makes me wild. With 30 years upon my head to have you call me child. Ship up.
You're listening to Only a Game. The last batch of emails from which I read was pretty cranky, which led John Husted, who hears the program on WICA in Interlochen, Michigan, to write, "It tickles me to hear extremely negative comments made in response to some of your offbeat reports. These critics should get a life. Keep doing what you're doing, ignore the nabobs of negativism, and have fun. As I never ignore people who quote Spiro Agnew, I think we will continue to have fun." In response to last week's program, Laura Frome, who hears Only a Game on WNIJ in Rockford, Illinois, wrote, "It makes me sad that Susan Butcher passed away and there was so little recognition of her accomplishments. Thank you for your commentary, reminding me what a great sportsman she was." Last week, Charlie Pierce and I speculated on whether Fidel Castro, who was photographed wearing an Adidas sweatshirt, might have signed an endorsement agreement with the company. John Virtue, who hears the program on WLRN in Miami, wrote to say that the garment in which Mr. Castro appeared, quote, happens to be the training sweatshirt of the Cuban national baseball team, which was why he was wearing it. And so that explains that. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Mark Lamster, the author of a book about baseball entrepreneur Albert Spalding's world tour in 1888. Alan Williams, a WBUR listener, wrote to say that in that conversation, I, quote, neglected to mention that Mr. Spalding's nephew, also Albert Spalding, was a well-known violinist who lived during the first half of the 20th century. I didn't know Albert Spalding had a violin-playing nephew, but if I had known it, I certainly would have neglected to mention it. Another WBUR listener, Irwin Abrams, chastised Only a Game for neglecting fencing. We were also taken to task this week for paying insufficient attention to netball. And finally, Jim Peel of the New England Union Referees Society felt that our story on the Saranac rugby tournament earlier this month focused too much on pain and damage. I think we'd happily put our injury statistics up against gridiron football, ice hockey, soccer, ultimate frisbee, or rock climbing, he wrote. Next time, you might at least send someone who knows there aren't any face-offs in rugby. You can let us know what you think about our stories by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon.
No, you're not.
Why listen to the newsy prattle from Weekend Edition Saturday? I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
This week at the World Basketball Championship in Japan, the U.S. team was undefeated in their group. Based on the results in the other groups, which team's likely to give them serious opposition from here on in?
Well, the other undefeated squads are Spain, Greece, and Argentina. Argentina, of course, is probably the best of those three. That would be the team I would be most concerned about. They're going to have an interesting little game with Australia in the first round of the round of, in the round of 16. I like the way this USA basketball team is playing right now. I like the fact that they were able to rest Dwayne Wade against Senegal, that Chris Bosh came in and did what he had to do, got 20 points, and that the people in Japan were chanting for my fellow former warrior.
Charlie, I don't know if you're ready for some football, as that ever-fresh and clever question has it, but Bryant Gumbel has already thoroughly upset everybody from former Commissioner Paul Tagliabue to former quarterback Joe Theismann. How'd he manage that?
By telling the truth about the status of the NFL Players Association and Gene Upshaw. The football players are the least well-represented of any players who aren't hockey players. They have the shortest career lives. Their money is not guaranteed. Their bodies are utterly disposable. And their union has done an awful job of protecting their well-being and their rights as employees. And if you're the head of a union and the head of management is coming to your defense, something's gone a little awry here. And for the and because Gumbel, I think, stupidly took a job with the NFL Network, he's vulnerable on this.
Speaking of people speaking their minds, maybe it's time for New York Jets running back Kevin Barlow to learn to self-edit a little when describing San Francisco 49ers coach Mike Nolan.
Don't call people Hitler. It's what's called Godwin's Law on the Internet. It immediately eliminates your argument. You call somebody a dictator, you know, lowercase d. All football coaches are, and in their heart of hearts, they love being dictators. Don't be calling folks Hitler, especially Mike Nolan. I mean, Mike Nolan, Hitler, maybe one of the minor Somozas, but Hitler? No.
NFL players are known for bellyaching about their pay, Charlie, but it seems to me that wide receiver Ashley Lalee might actually have a point. If the Broncos choose, it looks like Mr. Lalee might have to pay to play for the team. How does this work?
Well, his total fines for not reporting and skipping workouts, and he's supposed to be a Falcon now, but he's not really going to be a Falcon now, would total $378,000, and the Broncos are going to try to get a share of his signing bonus from 2002 back. And apparently, to get rid of him, they're willing to not do that. But it is entirely possible that without some very creative accounting, Ashley Lalee will have to pay to get into an NFL stadium this year.
This week, sprinter Justin Gatlin, the fastest man in the world, was banned from track and field competition for 8 years and will likely lose that aforementioned title. But there's at least some indication that Mr. Gatlin won't be going down alone.
Yes, for what is essentially a lifetime suspension. 8 years is a lifetime suspension. He's not going to, if he comes back at the age of 32 and runs another 9.7, they're just going to test him again anyway.
Then he'll be positive again if he does that.
You know, he has apparently decided to become a Fink whistleblower and provide some information to the USADA on the people who are alleged to have, but he says didn't give him the performing enhancing drugs that have caused his 8-year suspension.
Speaking of Gatlin's coach, Trevor Graham, another of his former athletes, sprinter Marion Jones, said that she was shocked this week that she had tested positive for EPO back in June. Given the number of scandals Ms. Jones has managed to skirt, were you also shocked?
Well, I was shocked that at this late stage in her career, she actually flunked a drug test. I mean, she should be awfully good at this by now. I mean, I guess when you get old, your testing ability slows down.
You get
along with
careless
else.
About these.
You get a little reckless. And and Latasha Jenkins, of course, as another athlete coached by Trevor Graham, tested positive for nandrolone in July, which, of course, has leaked to the news media, as all these things do. And I think we should note for the record that Jaime Ostefan, the physician who shot Ben Johnson full of stanozolol, in 1988, causing the first of the great steroid kerfuffles, passed away this week.
Charlie, since you and I last spoke, Tiger Woods has won another major golf tournament, which makes 12 of same, and his second major this summer. Remember when he was in a slump?
This happens all the time. It happened after he won his first Masters in 1997. He tinkers with his swing. He grows himself a little goatee, and then he comes back, and he's dominant for 2 or 3 years. The PGA win was embarrassing. I mean, it was wonderful golf to watch as an exhibition, but nobody stepped up. The course was a joke. So, yes, he is definitely back. He's a different player. He's a smarter player. He's a canny. He's not a smarter player so much is that he's using his shot-making ability in a more creative way. He's, I think, a more interesting player to watch now.
From Friday through Monday, the Boston Red Sox went about emptying the American League East of the tension that it had previously contained. And by golly, they did a thorough job of it, didn't they?
Boy, they stunk. I mean, I was in attendance for the endless German opera, Russian novel, day-night doubleheader last Friday. The hard thing for the Red Sox to realize now is that even as bad as they were in that endless doubleheader, the other three games were winnable. They were ahead on Saturday and Sunday, and Monday was a 2-1 game, and they could have come out of that winning 3 out of 5. They're pitching. Josh Beckett finally pitched a good game on Thursday night. They beat the Angels 2-1. Now you've got David Ortiz with a heart murmur or something. It is a strange and long glide, I think, to the finish to the Red Sox, who I don't believe are going to catch the Yankees.
There were some odd occurrences elsewhere in baseball, too. After the Detroit Tigers beat the Chicago White Sox on Monday night, Chicago manager Ozzie Guillen, who had been tossed from the game for arguing balls and strikes, said it could have been much worse.
One of the great quotes of this or any other season. He said, if I said what I wanted to say, I would get suspended for 20 years. They would maybe fine me $100 million. Aw, come on. You know something that's worth $100 million to say, you got to say it.
My favorite single unlikely development in baseball involved the Kansas City Royals, Charlie, a team for which fans should perhaps never again assume that things can't get worse. When you score 10 runs in the first inning, man, you usually win the game.
Creeping back. Here come the Indians. You want to know how a team gets to be 46-82? I'll tell you how a team gets to be 46-82, Bill. They fail to hold a 10-run first inning lead in their own ballpark.
And finally, Charlie, 12-year-old Bethany Mulcahy was definitely the luckiest girl at a church picnic in Pennsylvania, although her parents encouraged her to lose money to support the church charity. Try as she might, poor Bethany just could not comply. You want to give us a rundown
of
her winning?
I'm going to try, because this is a little bit confusing. But she goes, and they played some bingo, and she won $10. After failing to knock her cousin in the water at the dunking booth, the only game she lost at, by the way, the entire day at the fair, she went to play instant bingo, and she won $50. Bingo! Then she started playing a pick six wheel and won $6. Pick six! She goes home to Virginia with, you know, a little bit of money in her pocket. And before leaving the picnic, however, her father had bought two $2.50 raffle tickets, and he put Bethany's name on one of them. And what happened? Bethany won the car. Pontiac! Good for her. She's taking the cash equivalent, $13,500, and going to college on it.
And she will be on TV picking NFL games Sunday, right?
And I think her poor cousin is still sitting on the dunking stool wondering how the hell she managed to miss on the throw.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and his new book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, will be published very soon. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. There was a girl who had a dog, and bingo was his name. Oh, B-I-N-G-O, 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 and bingo was his name. Hey, hey, hey. Woof. Bingo is a dog, bingo is a dog, bingo chews his heart and breaks his tail. You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcast, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org.
Did you know that you can take a course in tree climbing? And this is not apparently just a course for scholarship athletes looking to remain eligible. It's a course you can take if you're just a kid or if you are old enough to have thought your tree climbing days were over forever. KUNC's Nancy Greenlease has our story from Wheat Ridge, Colorado.
Sometimes hugging a tree isn't enough. That's when Ponderosa Harv comes to the rescue.
Okay, so let's pretend you're a tree. So let's spread your legs.
Harv Teitelbaum raises his hands high, and without a snicker, a group of grown-ups and kids follow suit. The 55-year-old gray-haired man looks like the college professor that he is, only with a buff body usually reserved for co-eds. In this park in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, Teitelbaum, whose name in Yiddish roughly translates to pointer tree, has his charges gyrate wildly to stretch their limbs before tackling those of a nearby cottonwood.
Very nice, but then we get a big chinook and the whole trunk is moving. The whole trunk, but don't get blown over. You're still rooted to the ground. Very nice. Very nice. Good trees. Good trees.
Janet Gunn is the ancient redwood among this group. She's raven-haired, strong, and, well, no longer a sapling.
I'm 60 years old, and I think I probably never climbed a tree after I was 10. 50 years ago. Just yesterday.
But Gunn and her fellow climbers are eager for Dances with Branches. That's the name of Teitelbaum's course that teaches participants how to safely climb a tree. Gunn selects one of the ropes that is looped over a wide branch, which will act as a pulley. She steps into a canvas harness that looks like a fancy diaper and turns to Teitelbaum for final adjustments.
Okay.
Everything is perfect. Everything is exactly like it's supposed to be. The world is like it should be. You're on your way.
Thank you.
She pulls down on one end of the rope, which scooches her up a few inches.
Okay. Now I have to rest a minute. That is some work.
With each tug of the rope that can handle 6,000 pounds, Gunn moves closer to the tree's lime green leaves. But right now, she's barely off the grass.
Seems like my legs should be straight out there. Inchworm, inchworm.
On the other side of the tree, 7-year-old Jeffrey Reed and 9-year-old Jacques Murrow are hanging out about 2 stories above the ground. They're seasoned backyard tree climbers, what enthusiasts call free climbing, but that limits them to trees with low branches. Using ropes opens up a sky-high playground for them.
Whoa.
So how's it different up there? What are you seeing that's different?
Squirrels running all over the place. You can see the top of the trees better. Higher. The highest you go, the people are smaller.
Longtime climbers say birds often perch nearby, and elk and deer strut below, not knowing that a potential predator is in their midst. Peter Jenkins has enjoyed this bird's-eye view for decades. The senior arborist for the city of Atlanta caught the attention of locals years ago while he tended the city's trees. He says people watching him pined for a chance to get up in the tree and play.
I'd be laughing and screaming and yelling, just happy as a lark that here I am climbing. I'm making a living climbing. It's fun. It's exciting.
So Jenkins, known as the Tree Man, founded Recreational Tree Climbing. During the past 23 years, he's taught thousands to climb the 2 giant oak trees on his Atlanta property and mentored most of the world's tree climbing instructors. The former rock climber prefers scaling trees because he says it's less dangerous, more shady, and above all, relaxing.
Sometimes I think that it's maybe a genetic response because it used to be a place of safety for us as humans, trees. You know, during the day we do our foraging and then we go back up in the trees in the nighttime. So I think something like that kicks in because when you get into the tree branch system up there, it just seems calm, sort of like a coming home.
And tree climbers do learn to take care of their cribs. The rope is threaded through a hose that rests on the branch and protects the bark. Showing respect for trees is important to Teitelbaum, who studies the psychological benefits of nature. I get a little couch time in his leafy second home, another cottonwood called Old Scratchy.
We're in the tree, and it's fun. You know, it's fun just kind of bouncing around, bouncing off the tree, and you, whoa, there we go.
Took a little swing there. That's fun. Am I allowed to do that, too?
You can do that. Yeah, you can do anything you want. It's okay to have fun in a tree. No one's going to say, you come down right now. You know, stop playing around that tree. You come right down now and do your homework and do your chores. Nope, you're an adult. You can do this. You can have a good time.
Looking down, Teitelbaum says tree climbing gives him a new perspective. The tops of the limbs are surprisingly darker than the bottom, seen from below. The leaves look somewhat limp. The angle changes things.
It's another world. It's vertical. You know, we go to for our vacations hundreds of miles horizontally, when you can just go 100 feet vertical and totally escape, but escape back into yourself almost, into something that is core of who we are.
Back with the climbing group, it's survival of the fittest as a girl zooms past a cluster of huffing adults.
Emma's going to pass you here soon, Rick.
Yes, she is. Yay, Emma! Did you do this professionally?
No.
Later, 11-year-old Emma Bleesner pushes down on one of the rope's knots to gently lower herself to the ground. In her sore hands, she clutches some souvenir pods and a leaf.
It was really fun. Feels like you're a monkey.
Swinging from branch to branch.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of a monkey's life now?
Must be hard and fun.
For 60-year-old Janet Gunn, it was a trip back to when she was about Emma's age and living in Kansas. Smiling and teary-eyed, she says she met her former self.
You know, my kid got to play today. She's pretty excited about that.
Touch some feelings that you haven't had for a long time.
She was kind of wishing her brothers were there.
Whether emotional or not, the climbers agree that it is at the very least an adventure. Allison Lorne says that alone makes tree climbing worthwhile.
Sometimes you just get in a rut and you need to just branch out. And a bunch. That was good.
For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Wheat Ridge, Colorado.
You look pretty comfortable there.
It is pretty comfortable right here.
I am a tree. I show my age when I don't cry. I have a leaf that will fall off when wind blows by. Don't strip off my bark. I have been stripped of it before. Just yesterday's gone and tomorrow has so much more in store.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Matt Odette. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to see photos of tree climbing or the Fool's Rules Regatta, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Dave Sereva, who tells us what he's going to do with the money when the Brushback Report starts flying off the shelves.
If that becomes a bestseller, I'm going to spend all my time with the track. That's my ambition, you know.
Yes, yes, I do know. For what's a man without his ambition? I'm Bill Littlefield. Give me $10 on the 5 to win. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.